foggy evening. My name is Natalie Turvey. I'm the Executive Director of the Canadian Journalism Foundation. And on behalf of the Foundation and our sponsor, BMO Financial Group, I'd like to welcome you to tonight's forum, Social Media Meets Traditional Election Coverage. Before I introduce our moderator, I want to say a few words about the Canadian Journalism Foundation. The CJF is a not-for-profit organization whose goal is to facilitate and celebrate excellence in journalism. We're working for better journalism through events like this, our seventh this season, through Canada's top two journalism information and ideas websites, jsource.ca in English and projetj.ca en français, in collaboration with the country's top journalism schools, and through an executive education program run with the Rotman School of Management at the University of Toronto, and through our annual awards gala, which takes place this year on June 7th, and at which we'll present a Lifetime Achievement Award to Patrick Brown in recognition of his spectacular 20 years as a foreign correspondent in trouble spots around the globe. We'll also pay tribute to a Canadian luminary who has made an extraordinary contribution to journalism on the international stage. A few years ago, it was Morley Safer, and this year we'll be honoring Robert McNeil. And we're delighted to welcome Donna Friesen, Global National's anchor and executive editor, as host of this year's gala. Our mantra at the CJF is that as journalism goes, so goes democracy, and we're working for better journalism. All right, to tonight's forum, social media meets traditional election coverage. The day after the election writ dropped, the Globe and Mail declared, Canada's first social media election is on. And today, one of their columnists suggests that the social media election will start after the polls close. There are more voters using social media than in any other previous federal election. And I think Mark's going to have some great stats to share with us. But are 140 characters enough to make or break an election campaign? Will social media bring out the tech-savvy youth vote? Which candidate will have the most Facebook friends and Twitter trend scores? I think 2 months out, we can probably all agree that it's Rick Mercer. We've assembled a guest panel to discuss the answers to these questions and a lot more. Our moderator is Jesse Hirsch. Jesse is an internet strategist, researcher, and broadcaster. As a freelance journalist, he's been doing radio and television for a decade and a half, having worked for CFRB, Jazz FM, TVO, Global TV, City TV, Rogers, Omni, and Much Music. Currently, he has a weekly nationally syndicated column on CBC Radio explaining and analyzing the latest trends and development in technology. Educated at the McLuhan Program at the University of Toronto, his passion is educating people on the potential benefits and perils of technology. In keeping with tonight's theme, you can join the conversation with our live online coverage at live.jsource.ca or on Twitter at hashtag CJFForums. Ladies and gentlemen, your moderator, Jesse Hirsch.
Thank you very much to all of you for trekking out on what's a rather cold day in April and for a subject that has been analyzed rather extensively, even though we're still about 13 days away from voting day. Tonight, though, I think we are going to have a very critical, a very interesting discussion, not so much trying to assess whether it's a social media election, but rather looking at the way social media is playing a role in our understanding, our participation, our perhaps criticism of the election as a whole, in that I think clearly it's the volume and the passion that the new media are bringing that merits the type of attention that we'll have. The format for tonight's discussion is to have a brief presentation followed by a bit of a panel discussion, but I'm very much interested in getting your input and getting your participation. So the moment I see people starting to stir in their seats, we'll open it up, and certainly you're welcome to use electronic media to participate before that point, but I would encourage, in the spirit of the age of interactivity, that you might heckle, that you might vocally interact if you feel that the media provides too much intermediation. And in that sense, I'd like to begin by introducing the fine folks who have joined us here tonight. And I'll go in reverse order of speaking, but in the order of immediacy to myself. Chris Boutet is with the National Post, and is one of their senior digital editors, producers, do everything and anything that needs to be done. He's worked on a number of interesting projects that he'll be able to share with us tonight. But he also has some interesting ideas himself in terms of the use of social media within journalism, within politics, that we'll hopefully be able to extract. To his right, Kenyon Wallace from the Toronto Star, who is an editor, producer, a similar type of newfound journalist who has to do anything and everything to get the job done. As part, I believe, editor of the politics page on the Toronto Star website, and is helping to coordinate the Youth Voices blog.
Youth Nation blog,
which has a lot of interesting young voices providing a unique perspective. And finally, our primary presenter, Mark Blevis, who has joined us from Ottawa, who has experience both in the public and private sector, has been doing a lot of interesting quantitative analysis in terms of taking some of the analytics software, taking some of the ability to crunch the data and try to understand what's going on from essentially a big picture type of view. So we thought it would make sense for Mark to start our evening so that we were all theoretically on the same page, but also so that we had some empirical data to start from our conversation so that we don't do the usual sort of hot air blowing, which of course we do encourage, hence the heckling. But I think we'll give Mark 20 minutes to set the frame, provide a bit of context in terms of what's happening online with regard to the election. So please, Mark.
Thank you very much, everybody. Just call up my... I like to put slides up so it gives people another place to look. I should start by saying that when I do presentations, I like to do presentations that, especially for the journalism folk, that have a story arc in the beginning, the middle, and the end. And I find myself sadly in a predicament where we're halfway into an election and in the very early days still of social media and politics. So I'm sorry I can't provide you an ending tonight, but if we want to get together maybe on May 3rd and have a beer and we can talk a little bit about what happened, I'd be happy to do so. The other thing is that with respect to politics and social media, when you think about it, I was 11 when I first had a taste of politics. I helped a friend of the family actually, run for back then, it was called alderman, but a city councilor. And back in the day, I remember on polling night, there was a big, huge wall that had all the tickets up of the identifying the polls. And the phone would ring every 20 minutes or 25 minutes, and everybody would get quiet, and somebody would take the information, then they'd run up and write it on a card and put it on the wall. Last election, which wasn't so long ago, 2008, if you weren't aware, Twitter lit up. As the polls closed in Newfoundland and worked westward, the polling results were already online in many ridings, and candidates declared in many ridings based on polling numbers that were going out online, before the West Coast even closed, which posed problems, of course, for Elections Canada. And I suspect that we can, if nothing else for social media, we can expect that on election night. Peace, order, and Googleable government that's up there, that the reason why I kind of got into doing the election coverage that I've done is I've done some reports, and my most recent was called Peace, Order, and Googleable Government. And in it, I looked at the use of social media by politicians. And not surprisingly, things have changed substantially since I put out my report in February. Back then, there were even, I think, 13 MPs who didn't even have a website. Now, if you run an election, you're at a severe disadvantage if you don't even have a place where people can find information about you online. So I'm just going to, I put some visuals up, and I've got some fun things up here. If I'm boring, you can read these. These screenshots are all taken of tweets, with the exception of the two in the corners, during debate night, showing some of the activity. Debate night, there were 38,000 tweets. I haven't done the math, but if I had to do it quickly, I would say that's probably one every 2 seconds for the duration of the debate. Is that right? For the duration of the day. That'd be one every 2 seconds for the duration of the day. We start off in the top left-hand corner, though. That's kind of noteworthy, because at the very beginning of the election, Stephen Harper did something he had never done before, which was put out a tweet which involved his family. And I think that was probably almost as scandalous as the fact that he was on Twitter putting out stuff like that. But the fact that he'd waited so long for an election campaign to expose a little bit more of a human side, a family side to him online. And then the bottom right-hand corner is when the gauntlet dropped on the one-on-one debate. And that's really when we started to see a lot more interest increase in the role of Twitter online. The other tweets were all from the debate night and other memorable nights or moments I wanted to capture just to set the framework for my talk. And I'm probably going to get excited as I go. Hopefully I can confine myself to the 20 minutes. This is, of course, the Facebook profile for the young woman who was screened, first went public with being screened out of a conservative conservative event, because she had a photograph on her Facebook profile with Michael Ignatieff. But what does all this mean, all this traffic? To give you a sense of how much is going on, I've run some analysis. I use a tool called Sysomos Map, which is a tool that you know, it's a service that you have to pay for. But I use it for a lot of my own research and for work that I do with clients. And when the election started, I started diving into how the online world was talking about Twitter. There's a lot of people actually who've talked about the role of social media in campaigning. And there's a significant role, and that's a whole separate talk. I don't know if we'll get into it tonight. What I've really focused on in my coverage is what Canadians are talking about, what's on Canadian minds online. So when I get criticized, for example, of putting too much emphasis on Twitter, a lot of it probably has to do with the fact that in our first 20 days of the election campaign, we had 398,469 tweets. We actually started out the very first day of the election, there was about 9,000 tweets. The day after was a little bit more, about 10,000, so that works out to one tweet every 9 seconds of those days. And there's also other activity, of course, 58,000, well, almost 59,000 mentions in the news, and almost 19,000 mentions in blogs. There's also some forum activity, actually, for those of you who don't remember forums, because it's been a while since they've been really talked about. Discussion forums, in many ways, were some of the earlier forms of social media. People could post a question or a thought on a discussion group, and people would respond to it. And it's amazing that forums actually are very much alive, specifically in niche topics. So what do those big numbers mean? Well, Twitter is that top line that spikes at about 73,000 on April 12th, debate night. So the most trafficked night of Twitter during the election was the debate night. Prior to that, I think our biggest day was about 23,000. But the lines below that are forums, news, and blogs. So when you look at share of voice, Twitter is where the action is, which is probably a large reason why Twitter's gotten the attention it has gotten, and people have referred to this as the Twitter election. I've kind of taken a different approach, and I blogged about this, the idea of it being the velocity election. And I'll show more about why I call it the velocity election in a couple of slides. Share of voice in the bottom left, bottom right-hand corner, pardon me, shows that once you factor in Twitter, we have about Twitter has about 80% of the overall share of voice, which is a pretty significant chunk of the online coverage, and when you even factor in mainstream media. No, that's fine. Yeah.
What does that mean, share of voice? I mean, how does that relate to substance and content?
Oh, well, substance and content don't matter. it's very interesting, though, because on the point of substance, a lot of people have accused Twitter of being mundane. They see tweets like, I like toast, or I'm having toast, or I've forgotten the famous one, I forgot how much I like pickles. And a lot of people say that's mundane. What's really interesting is for one of my clients, it's turned out to be a treasure trove of information about Canadian diet. We're able to go onto Twitter and monitor Canadian conversations, find out what people are saying they're eating. And we're able to determine, you know, what percentage of Canadians are online that are reporting when they're eating are actually eating a healthy meal or getting their proteins and their fibers and all these other things rather than Doritos. And the other thing is, it's amazing how many people tweet about going to a vending machine. So a lot of it is mundane, but it's valuable content in some respects. So when you talk about the quality of the signal versus the quantity of the signal, or the volume of information that's being put out, I haven't really gone into the measure of the quality, because there's just too much quantity. And actually, this election has really shown that if you're going to follow the general conversation, it's a full-time job. which is why you need some of these tools to parse the information for you, and then you can start to dig down into the weeds. The but there's some if we go back a couple. The National gets that many viewers. Well, I think the reason why tweets would be exciting for people, one is it shows that people are engaged in a conversation, they're sharing their thoughts, but also a tweet. Yeah, the other thing is when 400,000 people watch the National News, they don't participate in the National News, they consume the National News. And here are 4,000 people who are sharing their insight into what they're thinking, and they're connecting with other people. The other thing is they might link to news articles, link to blog posts. So it's a very much a web effect, and there's an amplifier effect that connects all these things.
And I think to be clear, the 400,000 is definitely not people. There's a lot less people making those 400,000. So the number is even smaller than it appears.
Yeah, we haven't dug deep to find out how many. I mean, that 400,000 people could be 10,000 people, just tweeting a lot. There's also the danger of what they call robots, which is, with all due respect, some news organizations build software that put out headlines every time a new article is put out. And so that's not a bad thing, but it's a robot, it's not a human being engaging in conversation, it's a broadcast of a message. There are also some robots that go out and they'll look for people. For example, if I tweeted about an iPod the other day and I got a robot response within a moment telling me about iPod deals, if I wanted to buy an iPod. I was actually tweeting about the iPod tax at the time. So let's move through the numbers and see why these numbers are perhaps a little bit interesting. When you talk about 400,000 tweets online, that's 308 million impressions is the estimate. That means that there's 308 million opportunities for people to see that tweet. So that's where those numbers start to gain a little bit more relevance. So if you're talking about 400,000 people watching the National, that's... Okay. Yeah, so, and they have that moment where they're watching the National, and the National, of course, puts stuff online as well. I would argue that while the National's live telecast is very important, and that they're reaching, you know, millions of people with that one telecast that's taking place in a moment, there's probably, their online content probably has a greater impact because it has longevity to it. And 308 million impressions might bring awareness to people. For example, of those 308 million, there's probably a good chunk of them that don't watch the National. So even though that might not necessarily, you know, it might be 1 million people that the National could potentially reach through online.
Really,
oh, no.
Really,
I understand, no. The big numbers like this are very ethereal and hard to follow. No.
Are your feelings hurt, Mark?
My feelings are not hurt. Okay. This is, you know, this is very new territory, and it's complicated. You know, especially when you look at numbers this big, does it really actually, like, what does it mean? I mean, the closest we can get to understanding what numbers like that mean is when you look at that. It's like, well, there's a big white space between the top line and the next line down. So, yeah. It's a measure of opportunities by which, an opportunity for that message to be seen. So if somebody puts a tweet out, so if Jesse were to tweet right now about this event, that's right, it's around the world. That is around the world. So if Jesse were to tweet about this event right now, to clarify, the 398,000, those are Canadian tweets, but the impressions are international. So if Jesse were to tweet about this event right now, Jesse, how many followers do you have?
3,500.
So 3,500 people might see that tweet initially, within his network, and there might be other people who are following certain keywords that Jesse might use within the message. So stick with me for a moment. So we have those 3,500.
And speak up, too, because there's no microphones in the crowd, if you can't tell.
Yes. It would seem to me that it's very, very important also to measure impact. Now, you have a human being on a TV set in your home, you're relaxed, you're not doing anything, and if the human being's any good, not that they are, if it's any good, that human being will have a tremendous impression on you.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas just another tweet, it's one more in a million.
Well, and on debate night, we saw that because 38,000 tweets in a few hours, I mean, it's noise, and you don't really have a chance to appreciate what's being said, intelligent or not, unless you're Rick Mercer, in which case you get retweeted a lot. So you're absolutely right. You have to be able to sift through the signal, the noise, to get to the signal. To get to the point on the impressions, what that's doing is it's measuring how many times that Twitter message, or the messages in this case, would be seen by others. So the 3,500 followers that Jesse has and the handful of other people that might find his tweet based on keywords, so they're searching on Google or on Twitter for specific keywords, might then also retweet the message. So every time that message gets retweeted, it fans outwards. You know, it has this web effect and it amplifies outwards. And so that 308 million considers the original tweet, any replies, any retweets, so as the message filters through the internet and then potential as well for being found on Google and other locations as well.
So, and I think all of these questions are helpful in part because there's clearly a lot of assumptions in terms of these numbers and the way this data is analyzed that, you know, people I think need to grasp their head around. So to use Rick Mercer as an example, he is clearly a Twitter star as he is a TV star. Do you think he's getting a greater reach with his tweets than he does with his show?
No, but I feel people will feel that they feel close to Rick Mercer because they're following him, they're getting content from him in real time, so they feel like he's directing it at them and they can interact with him. There's actually, which brings to mind another point about this. With respect to the election campaign, I believe, without having asked the people specifically, that there's an epicenter of people in the political discussion from which everything is emanating. And those people are either politically engaged, politically involved, or politically interested. On Twitter, that's right. So the average Canadian is not necessarily following the political discussion. But what's happening is it's emanating from this epicenter of people. And as they tweet, the example I used with Jesse, with his 3,500 people, Jesse probably has friends who are, you know, journalists or music lovers or parents or, you know, hockey fans or whatever. Suddenly, this political tweet is ending up in other arenas, other discussions that otherwise hadn't considered this political discussion. Jesse says something that resonates with them, they will then either respond to him or retweet it. And then it just keeps fanning out into areas, like I said, that are outside this political epicenter, which is important because that's how some Canadians are getting their information. The Canadians who aren't following the Twitter discussion might not realize that they're impacted by it because there are people like Katie O'Malley and Andrew Coyne and David Akin, and the list goes on, who are following the political discourse and are factoring that into their coverage as well. The echo chamber? So the question is the technology, I realize I should probably echo the question. So is the technology really expanding the conversation? This slide actually speaks to this a little bit. Because what I've found in the analysis I'm doing of the online conversation, everybody talks about conversation. Twitter is so great, people can engage with each other. They can talk and they can have a discourse. But if you look at this pie chart at the bottom, original content accounts for less than 40% of what's going on. and replies, so actual conversation, so people responding to what's being said, is slightly less than 16%. The remainder is what I call the amplifier effect, retweets. So there's about 47% of the people aren't responding. They see something interesting and they may or may not tack a comment onto it when they just rebroadcast it. They're kind of like a relay tower. They receive a signal, oh, this is interesting, I'll pass that one along. And so really, it's all we see is an amplifier effect. So when we talk about Jesse's tweet going out to his 3,500 people, the message spreads very quickly, but we can't tell for sure, maybe on election night we'll know, what impact that has. But we can tell what issues are resonating with people. Let me take two questions and then I'll move on to another slide.
Why don't you, given that I think the crowd is far more interested in interacting on the issues than in necessarily going over the numbers, why don't you try to go through the presentation while answering the questions at the same time, if you think such ambidextrous presentation styles are
okay, possible. So in which case, let me go into this because this kind of speaks to the how quickly the conversation changes and what role it plays. This is a chart, actually two graphs of a combination of issues that I've been tracking over the course of the election. What you see, I'm not going to go into the details of all of them, but what's really important to note is how quickly things go up and how quickly they go down. So issues gain traction very quickly online. They spread very quickly. I don't like to use the word, but to use a language that people might be familiar with, viral. By the way, you don't create viral in the online world. Viral happens because something is said and it resonates with people. So if, for example, Michael Ignatieff tweets anytime, any place on a one-to-one or one-on-one debate, that gets people excited. It resonates with them. Ooh, a cat fight, and then they retweet it. So it gets a spike. Elizabeth May being excluded from the debates gets a spike. So we see on the top chart, I'll just walk through some of these really quickly. It opens up with the top line on coalition. So they out of the gate, coalition was the number one issue. But it drops off fairly quickly and kind of vanishes into obscurity for the remainder of the 20 days that I'm looking at here. Our first big spike on May 29th is Elizabeth May being excluded from the debates, and it's almost immediately knocked out of the running by the very next day when the one-on-one debate happens. It starts to chew up some of her traction. Then we see on April the 3rd, we see the Liberal platform gets launched, and so it spikes, and it drops off very quickly. So what we see on Twitter is two things. Issues gain traction very quickly, and very quickly we lose interest in them. Helena Gurgis last Thursday and Friday counted for 1,700 tweets, and now nobody's talking about it online. iPod tax has never really landed. It has 1,200 tweets in the first 20 days. So for the Conservative Party, it's probably not a wise investment for them. So you can see for campaign managers especially, following what's going on online can help inform agility and changes in the campaign. But the other thing that we're seeing with Twitter is, of course, with the 140 character limitation, is that issues that resonate with people and get traction are ones that have an emotional center to them or that are not nuanced. So the G8 draft report, for example, very easy to understand. Spent money where they shouldn't have spent it, didn't tell Parliament. That fits nicely into 140 characters. But healthcare challenges and economy and all the different elements of education are really hard to describe. And so they don't fit into 140 characters. They don't go very far. They do well in the blogs. Ethics barely ranks, yeah. Ethics is way at the bottom, yeah. What else do we have here? Senator Jake had a brief spike of, I think, 300 tweets on the day that he put out his attack dogs tweet, and then that issue was done. But what's amazing is even an issue like the G8 draft report, which everybody thought for sure was going to stick to the Conservatives and be a campaign changer, if not a campaign killer, died off very quickly. And in fact, it didn't even figure prominently into the debates. So that's how Twitter is really moving the conversation along. Now, if you follow my blog, you might see charts like this. And they're really not that hard to read, but they look complicated.
Actually, the text is kind of hard to read.
The text is, especially when I shrink them. But when I blog about them, I tend to summarize what's going on in them. The far left one is called a word cloud, and that shows word prominence, how often these words are appearing by the size and strength of the word. So, for example, youth vote, which is part of my search criteria, by the way, so it stands to reason it's prominent. Youth vote actually it would be used the most often out of all the words. And then you see other words like GPC, ashamed, Elizabeth May Inn, is the E May Inn kind of looking upwards. So all these different words, it's just a word cloud that's generated on the fly by the software that shows which words are figuring into the conversation in isolation of other words based on my search criteria. So it's when you're trying to figure out what people are talking about in ways other words to search for, it's kind of a helpful graph to have. But the more interesting one is the one on the right, because you can almost reassemble conversations based on that graph. It's called a buzz graph, and it shows how different elements of conversation are linked together. And there's three weights of lines. There's the solid thick line, the solid thin line, and then the dashed line, representing very strong connections, medium strength connections, and very, well, I won't say weak connections, but of the three, relatively weaker. So when we look in the center, we see Guelph, and then I did a search on this buzz graph. Actually has to do with what was being talked about in a particular frame of time online in the whole election. And what we can see here is that the epicenter of the conversation is Guelph, and then we see a voter, ballot, Canada, poll, stand. So you can probably figure out very quickly what we're talking about here. But what's really interesting is as we try to piece together the conversation and chase the elements of the conversation, the word connections help us look further into A, what's being talked about, and possibly the sentiment as well. So these are charts when I do my research that help me chase the story and find out what the story really is. Now these are all charts using a tool called Sysmos Map, and Jesse alluded in my introduction, or in the introduction of me, pardon me, of the analytics tools. And the analytics industry is quite large and very important, particularly for organizations and companies that are looking to make a splash online, because it allows them in some way, shape, or form to measure return on investment.
Excuse me, are you intimating that one can manage the conversation in terms of directing it to an area that one would benefit or another person's or another organization's detriment?
They can try, absolutely. I was careful in my choice of words when I talked about this in the media when the one-on-one debate issue came up. But at the time, I had pointed out that Stephen Harper and Michael Ignatieff, concerned that they're not getting as much media attention as, say, Elizabeth May is, might have crafted this one-on-one debate issue because they knew it was going to get traction. To his credit, Michael Ignatieff's tweet was probably the turning point in that people get excited by wording. It's not just about the message, but it's how the message is crafted. And his tweet, which I'll call up again very quickly because I like the way he worded it. A one-on-one debate, anytime, any place. I mean, it's kind of like watching a TV show and you can deliver a joke or you can deliver a joke out of the park. And that to me was delivering the joke out of the park, well, or delivering the message. And he nailed it just by his choice of words. And by that tweet, that tweet was retweeted like crazy. People loved it. It wasn't just, you know, yes, I would gladly have a one-on-one debate with you, you know, let's discuss. No, it was like a schoolyard, the two bullies in the schoolyard pushing each other around saying, all right, 5 o'clock over by Big Al's Diner in the parking lot. And everybody's like, yeah, I'm gonna be there. You know, for the people who were following the conversation, they felt like they were on the inside of something exciting. And there's cachet online when you talk about influence and clout. There's cachet if you're the one who first noticed it and sent it out to your network.
So how many more slides you got left in your deck?
I'll walk through very quickly. So let me just skim through these because I think we'll obviously cover
like
a lot of stuff.
2 or 3 minutes, because let's open it up.
Okay,
really
great, yeah. So Hootsuite is a free tool. And what I've got here is I've set myself up to monitor a number of conversations. One is I'm looking for when people mention my name in the far left, but I'm following political media, I'm following election chatter, and I'm following debate chatter. And with, sorry? Oh, Hootsuite, HOOTSUITE.com. you'll need a Twitter account.
Do you want to describe a little bit what it is?
Absolutely. So Hootsuite is like a dashboard for all of your social media accounts. So if you have a Twitter account, Facebook account, a LinkedIn account, for example, you can set yourself up to watch all of them on one screen and participate in conversations as a result. But you're also able to set up search criteria and lists of people that you want to follow. And then you can set them up in each one of these columns allows me to follow specific people or specific conversations. So if you're covering a story, for example, on Youth Vote, you can set up a search on Youth Vote and find out who's talking, find out what's being said, and find out who might be the most involved in the conversation, who's being replied to, who's being retweeted. In this particular case, I just happened to pull somebody up. This is a lobbyist from Ottawa who has 271 followers, and I'll get to followers in just a moment. But now we're able to see the information about the individuals by just clicking on their name. We can see a bio, if they've made a bio available, so we know who they are, we know where they are. He's in Ottawa. And Clout Score is a, there's a tool called clout.com, K-L-O-U-T.com, which will look at somebody's online activities and run a series of calculations to determine out of 100 how much influence they have. Now it's not a relative number, it's more of a calculation as to whether, you know, they can actually cause people to act. Tony Clement is a very, he's in the high 70s right now for influence. When he tweets, people will reply to him, they'll retweet him, people tweet about him. So as far as Clout is concerned, he's got cachet. In fact, he has more cachet than the Prime Minister does online. The Prime Minister, with his 130,000 followers, has an estimated reach of 9, which means when he tweets, he can probably count on about 9 people doing something about it. Tony Clement, when he tweets, can expect about 3,000 people to do something about it. Tony Clement has, I think, last count I looked, was 20-some-odd thousand followers. So he has a smaller percentage of followers, or a smaller number of followers, but a higher percentage of engagement and significantly more influence. So they might retweet, they might engage in a conversation with him, they might follow a link that he shares. So if he says, check out, you know, this website or check out this person, people will click on that link. So it factors all these different elements in determining how much influence he has. And Tony Clement has that influence because when he tweets, he's nonpartisan, he's interesting, and he finds a way to, now he's a little bit more partisan, obviously, in the election, but he did tweet the other day that the NDP candidate was out going door to door, and they bandied together, and they worked the street together, which I thought was interesting, because I think in the social media world, people like to see a different side of politics and politicians, rather than the finger pointing and the screaming that goes on in the House of Commons and on debate night. I talked about Youth Vote, so I was following the election coverage. I saw somebody had used the hashtag YouthVote, so I clicked on the hashtag. So a hashtag is a keyword. It's a word that identifies the conversation as being about a particular subject. So YouthVote has been identified for getting the youth out to vote. So I broke out the stream, so now I get to see specifically the conversation about YouthVote, and I can see who's tweeting about it, and who's replying, and who's retweeting. So if you're doing a story, for example, and you want to find, find out who you might speak to about the youth vote issue, this might be a great place to find sources as well, because you might find people who are organizing youth votes or who just participated in youth votes. In the case of, I think it was just yesterday, Stephen Wickery and I had been DMing back and forth because I had been interested in finding out whether photographs were actually taken of the ballot box being handled at Guelph. It was Guelph University, right? Yeah, and there are actually photographs. Somebody put up some photographs that they took. You don't actually see the ballot box being handled, but you do see a bit of a confrontation. You can see there's a bit of a heated discussion going on in the photographs. So I've actually come to essentially the end of my slides. Let me share something with you guys very quickly. I'll explain what I've done here. In Twitter, you can create a list of people that you would like to follow without actually having to follow them. And a lot of people don't like following politicians because they're afraid that they might give up political leanings. But you're able to follow people just by creating lists. So what we have here is that URL at the top, twitter.com/fullduplexca/, and then you can add any one of these other groupings onto the end to get the candidates for those parties. Now, the list might be a little bit imperfect, and some candidates put their accounts as private and some put them as public, and they change on the fly. So there might be some corrections that have to be made as we go through the election. But you, for example, if you wanted to follow the Conservative Party candidates that are on Twitter, you type that URL, and at the end of that slash, you would add ELXN41-CPC. And all the Conservative candidates who are tweeting, you'll get to see their information come up in a stream. So that's, in, I guess, my gift to you. Makes it easier if you're following candidates or following a particular party. If I had time, I would create one for each of the 308 ridings. But I don't. So you're welcome. And then if you're looking to contact me, that's my information. My logo, by the way, for fullduplex.ca just got finalized last night. My website doesn't exist yet. So if you go to fullduplex.ca, you won't find me. But markblevis.com is where I'm blogging about the election. If you have any questions, by all means, pass them along.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
And while originally this part of the evening was slated for a panel discussion, I think we will open it up immediately for a larger discussion amongst all of us, because I think there are a lot of issues that Mark's presentation bumped into, both in terms of some of the jargon and some of the concepts that have certainly been internalized by the social media set, perhaps falsely so, and it would be worthwhile to criticize. I was about to say I will give a very brief opportunity for our two other panelists, but I would encourage them to use the questions as an opportunity in a pedagogical sense to share your own work. We'll remind those of you who may have joined late, to my right here, Chris Boutet is from the National Post and is an every digital man in the sense that he can do just about anything and does. And Kenyon Wallace from the Toronto Star, both of whom are here today because they're doing really interesting projects as a part of the election with their outlets. So perhaps to start things off, and I would encourage all of you not just to ask questions, but to provide comments as well, if you would provide your own comments and maybe questions you have to the crowd on what you think is interesting in terms of the role of social media in this election. Chris?
Well, The thing there was a lot of very interesting information in that presentation. The thing that really stuck out for me was the chart where you were showing the life cycle of issues on Twitter. You know, it's I think, you know, there's a perception that issues are lasting longer than apparently they are, and you know, I feel it really speaks to the immediacy of the medium and the fact that you know, Kenyon and I, when we were talking last week, we were talking a bit about how much faster the news cycle has become because of this immediate, you know, platform, and it's just quite interesting to see, you know, how you know, something can, you know, live and die in 24 hours, and the next day no one's even talking about it anymore.
Yeah. There was a question earlier from someone over on this side of the room about along the lines of, so what? We have all this information. We know people are talking about it. Well, what does that mean? Well, I can tell you that as someone who also writes for the paper, we're seeing, to an extent that I don't think we've ever seen before, Twitter and Facebook and social media in general actually influencing the choice of stories that make it into the paper. So what we're having is, for example, I wrote a story last week, or was it a week before that? It came just after the initial news broke about this girl in London who was turned away from a university 2 weeks ago. Okay, there you go. That's how fast the news changes. And someone on Twitter, I think it was the girl from Guelph, had said, I went to this rally and they wouldn't let me in. And it was very short, but it was a tip that basically allowed me to develop it into a story. And it turned out that this girl had gone to a conservative event, a conservative rally featuring Stephen Harper. She had pre-registered. She's nonpartisan. She's not politically affiliated. And when she got there, she was told she wouldn't be allowed to come in. And she asked why and was told, well, were you ever a member of any kind of club on campus? And she had said something about, well, I was on a club that tried to get bottled water banned from campus. And they said, well, that's probably why you didn't get in. And so that became a story. And that came from social media. And we wouldn't have known that this situation had existed had she not tweeted about it. And that's just one example of stories that happened. Today, for example, there was a tweet that went out on Twitter, I guess around, 8 a.m., 9 a.m., along the lines of Julian Fantino has just shown up to a Passover meal to campaign. And this is tasteless, and how dare he do this? And that, I spent a lot of part of my day trying to track down whether that was true or not, because unfortunately, you can't get a lot of contact information off of Twitter. You have to try and find the person in real life. But that guided me to, it turned out not to be a story because that was an incorrect tweet, and he didn't actually go to this event. But that's another example of how it's actually influencing what journalists do on a daily basis. And I think part of the reason why the election cycle is so, the story cycle in the news is so quick is because there's one tweet after another that you pounce on because you're under pressure to do so, and that could become a story, or maybe it won't, but if it does, great, but then the next day someone tweets something else and then that becomes a story. So I guess what I'm trying to say is there are, you know, tweets and all this information actually translate into something physical and something that actually, you know, the news takes part of the news cycle up. So it does impact what journalists do.
Mark, do you want to respond to that?
Well, I'd like to build on that because you're absolutely right. And you use the example of story leads. I don't know how many people know of the story about Tony Clement and Stephen Harper tweeting the usage-based billing decision. So now we're starting to see, and it sent a ripple effect, but the ice is now being broken. So it's quite likely we're going to see policy announcements on social media. We saw the platform announcement that the Liberals did through a live stream. So people are starting to use the digital tools to reach out to people, and they're short-circuiting the media, potentially, actually quite clearly, in the case of the usage-based billing. And there were a lot of media that were upset about that. But they now are recognizing the power that they have in their hand to get a message unfiltered out to the public. And that's now it's, you know, journalists, as you point out, have the added stress of having to stay on top of it and follow what's going on. You know, which politician is going to tweet what today, and I want to be the first one on it because I've got to get out. And the other thing that we're seeing is the journalists are tweeting that they're working on the story, so if they get scooped in the meantime, they still have some sort of remark somewhere on record that they had it first. So social media is really changing the pace. And there are times that I've sat in a room with people at 6 o'clock with the news on, and they've said, that's old news. I heard that 4 hours ago. So, you know, that's the other challenge that's coming up.
Now, I would, of course, take this as an opportunity to point out there is a microphone set up there in the middle of the aisle. I would encourage people to please raise from your seats and stand at the microphone. We are recording this, so it would allow your comments to be recorded. I would make one a segue to mention the gentleman there in the second row asked about manipulation of Twitter and whether it can be used to create what's being called AstroTurf, which is the imitation of grassroots to create the perception of popular support. It's a really interesting project at the University of Indiana called Truthy, and the web address is Truthy, T-R-U-T-H-Y, .indiana.edu, and it's out of their computer science department, and they've successfully identified attempts, largely in the United States, in which the volume of data is greater, so they can both A, have more to work with, and B, detect when you have 200 accounts worked by a single piece of software, all talking about the same issue, creating the perception that that issue is of priority, and they're finding it to be rather remarkably widespread. So it certainly indicates there's a lot of work for the journalists to do in terms of trying to figure out what is real and what's not real. Mm-hmm. We do have one person in line, I think a second ready to go, and others who raised their hands. Please, by all means, come to the mic.
I was responding when you said that the information is coming to you unfiltered. And I dispute that because I suggest that perhaps the filter is the brevity of the message. And if all we can get through is a 140-character message, then the substantive issues drop by the wayside. Your charts clearly showed that. And so I think it's a terrible shame that, and I'm speaking as an old guy, that the social media has, especially Twitter, has condensed the issues to sound bites that are controlling the whole direction of the election. I think it's a terrible shame.
Well, I would argue that they're not necessarily controlling the direction of the election. The other thing is that Twitter is a great channel for broadcasting information. So for nuanced issues, for example, smart candidates aren't going to use Twitter to discuss those issues. What they will do is they might shoot a video or write a blog post or have a media release of some sort and then go on Twitter and announce, hey, Chrissy Clark, for example, just announced my family day policy on my blog or on my website, and she would link to it. So Twitter was a way of driving attention. If you want to get eyeballs, you want to get people to act very quickly, and you want the immediacy, Twitter, is, as we see, is quite likely the tool to use. If you want to offer substance, you want to address nuanced issues, then that's obviously not the right vehicle. But everything in concert, you know, and I didn't really get into this in my talk, for a campaign to be effective and to reach its masses and to persuade public opinion, it's not just about Twitter. It's you can't, for example, Twitter will never erase door-to-door knocking, and God help the candidate who decides that that's the way they're going to go. Maybe God is a little bit too far, but you know, good luck to the candidate who decides that Twitter is going to replace door-to-door knocking. Everything has to fit together. It all has to be integrated, and you have to use the right tools for the right things. Absolutely.
Can I add just one more thing to that? And I think any journalist worth their hide will say to you that, you know, they can get an idea from Twitter or an announcement from Twitter, but you're not going to use that as a source. You're going to find out who tweeted it, if it was actually that person who tweeted it, because a lot of politicians, I don't know if any of you guys were following Twitter during the debate, you know, a lot of the guys on TV at that moment were apparently tweeting as well. So, or they weren't, or they, someone's... Right, that's what I'm saying, that they weren't tweeting. So you have to make sure that if you read anything online, you got to take it with a grain of salt and find out who actually, you know, wrote it, because did Michael Ignatieff write his famous tweet? I don't know.
In his defense, actually, Michael Ignatieff did tweet before the debate that he was handing his BlackBerry to his assistant Adam Goldenberger, because I was actually watching the Twitter debate, and the Twitter stream, and every 5 minutes somebody else would say, hey, how is Michael Ignatieff tweeting? And this is the other thing, is then for the journalist, the job is, oh, how is he doing that? And then you have to go back and you have to find the answer. My understanding is Michael Ignatieff does his own tweeting and is pretty transparent when he hands it over to somebody else.
Yeah, so I thought that actually when you showed the tweet, the one-on-one debate one, it showed it had a suspicious amount of sophistication just in the addition of the period at the beginning of the tweet. Not a lot of people, let alone politicians, know that putting that before an at reply will allow everyone to see it. Whereas if you just started with an at reply, only the person you were speaking to and the people who follow the both of you would have seen it. So it was a little telling, but
everyone follow that pro Twitter tip.
Write that one down. Speaking to what Kenyon said about what people are trying to do effectively when they're using Twitter, when politicians are using Twitter, when people are writing what they think on Twitter, what they're trying to do is they're broadcasting their thoughts and they're trying to gain influence in some way. As you said, you engage in this activity in order to inspire activity in some way, some interaction. And, when it's becoming a primary source of information, as Kenyon said, these are more... what you see on Twitter are the kernels of ideas that reporters and observers, just viewers like you and I watching, we have to decide for ourselves whether or not we believe what is being said there. And Kenyon also mentioned there's a lot of pressure on reporters now with this abbreviated cycle. You know, you said something a little bit ago about how someone's like, oh, that's old news, that's 4 hours ago. Well, it's true. I mean, the office hours, ebb and flow of social media traffic have created a news cycle that we're talking about that is really 8 hours long. And when you're a reporter, you're an editor, and you're watching, you know, you see this thing start to happen, and then you see the build start to come, and you can see the wave rise of people retweeting, people talking, and you're like, oh, wow, this is a pretty big deal. I should really have something on this. And you feel this pressure to get involved because you know the difference between putting your voice in now and putting your voice in 2 hours later, you know, is the difference between tens of thousands of impressions of having an opportunity to get involved in that conversation as well. So, I mean, it's an incredibly powerful medium, but it's also a very dangerous medium, and a lot of reporters and editors have had to learn how to...
Gordon Lightfoot is dead?
Yes. Yeah, I worked for a news organization that killed Gordon Lightfoot a year ago on Twitter. It was... but we didn't kill Pat Burns. That was the second trial of Twitter in the news, in newsrooms. Because of the Lightfoot incident, and then again, some did the same mistake with Pat Burns, saying that he died when in fact he had not. All very unconfirmed. Is that it's kind of it's ingrained a sort of cynicism amongst you know, reporters as well as the media, or sorry, the public at large, which is necessary for sure.
I would, in introducing, again, people to line up at the microphone, I think when the panelists see people actually standing, it puts pressure on them to shorten their comments because they see so many others.
We'll talk. I'm a bit of a long talker. Sorry.
You're good at this. hi, my name is Michael Valpy. I'm a journalist. Mark, I want to push some of your information back to you and ask you if you can help me make more sense of it. You talked about, I think, there was about 47% of tweets are original content, and you also talked about the epicenter in a political debate. So I'm not sure whether epicenter and original content are the same thing or close to the same thing, which then leads me to ask you, I mean, what do we know about the demographics of tweeters? I mean, one of the things that we do know is that most of them are male. We know that most of them are over the age, I think, of 35.
Yep.
But we don't know much beyond that, and you could help me out on that. And because what
Wait, hold on. Yeah. Let's break this out in just a couple piece chunks so I don't lose.
Well, no, let's allow Michael to finish his.
But can you keep track?
The onus will then be on you.
I'll come
that's
back.
What I fear. Synthesize yeah. all of that, okay. And your fellow panelists are here to help.
Okay, good.
Because what I want to try to do, is understand how reflective is that tweet conversation of what actually the national debate is. And it must be pretty close, because I was fascinated by your chart of issues and where they were going. Now, you know, I look at the polls every single day, and your chart on issues aren't far off, or isn't far off, from the polls. So that's the end of my question. And so what I want, I've actually got a request. If we give you our email addresses, can you send us your slides?
Absolutely, good. Yeah.
So here we're going. What I'm trying to find out is how reflective of the Twitter conversation is the national conversation, given what we know or don't know of the demographics of tweeters.
Okay. So let me see if I can get, I'll try and be as brief as possible and capture as much as what you're looking for. So first of all, what you know about tweeters is about the best information that we have. People talk about Twitter or social media being a young person's game. The information actually suggests that for the most part, social media is really, I don't want to say, I'm 40, so it's really in my generation of people.
And it's actually quite conservative too, which surprises me.
It's funny actually, because I've seen what I've observed seems to be a little bit more skewing on the liberal side, okay. But who knows? It's really hard to say. Facebook skews female, and it's a little bit all over the place, but the largest growing demographic on Facebook is 50 and over. Twitter, 30, 35 to about 50 for the popular demographic there. Facebook also, of course, is very active in the young people. Young people are more on SMS and instant messaging and text messaging, so they're not as active on these open forum discussions. The epicenter is very much a focus group. I think you're right. It probably skews male, but we don't know very much about Twitter demographic because for the most part, people don't complete their profiles, and the profiles that they do complete don't ask for things like gender, age, stuff like that. Even, by the way, MPs are careless in their completion of their Twitter profiles, which makes it hard to find some of them. So they might not say where they're from, they might not put up an appropriate photo or a photo that identifies them. So if you have people like, Gordon, what's his name? Gordon Brown. There's a Canadian MP named Gordon Brown. Well, it's kind of hard to find Gordon Brown when there's a sea of Gordon Browns, including former UK parliamentarians. So we had...
To what extent does Twitter then correlate to the national public? Chris Kenyon, do either of you want to jump into that?
I think that's it's a fascinating question because, I guess like to ask that question, it sort of assumes that there's sort of some standardized national conversation against which we're measuring the conversation that's occurring.
Polling.
Polling. Okay, but I mean. The people that that conventional polls reach, I mean, the ways that polls are conducted are via landline, for the most part, you're shaking your head, it's fine.
Yeah, no, because people like Frank Graves at Ecos are using a much more sophisticated technique.
Sure, of course. I mean, there's many different varieties.
And also, you use this, part of the reason that Chris was invited onto the panel is he's doing a project called GeoPollster, which
right.
I think is relevant to introduce now as part of, mm-hmm. I'd say, early days of looking at how mobile polling needs to have location in order for it to be accurate. Do you want to share a little bit in terms of that project?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's relevant to what we're talking about in that, 2 weeks ago, National Post partnered with a Chicago-based location-based polling service called GeoPollster. And what they've done is they use an API of a social network called Foursquare. If there's any Foursquare users here, if there aren't any Foursquare users, I'm sure there are many, basically what it is it allows you to, it's a social network kind of game that allows you to check into a location and you'll get information about that location based on what your friends have left there as tips and stuff like that. But what GeoPollster allows you to do is anonymously associate a political affiliation to your persona. So now, whenever you're checking in, you're also registering somewhat of a vote for the party that you support. And so on the National Post site right now, at nationalpost.com/geopollster, we have a live updating cumulative map of voter sentiment across Canada based on the places that people are checking in and the real-life activities that they're engaging in. It's an interesting experiment, and partly we entered it because we... for what we're talking about, that we felt that conventional polling methods were unsatisfying, and they miss out on a large portion of a huge demographic that isn't involved in that. And of course, the next time we have an election, God willing, that's in 4 years, and not shorter. But we'll mobile polling, location-based polling, we think will have a stronger impact. It'll be a larger part of that conversation. So.
What I think is really fascinating, by the way, about the mobile polling is it's very early days, so it's not without its challenges, and I'm sure there are people who are going to challenge and dismiss it. But it opens up a lot of questions and opportunities, not the least of which is, A, to what degree does it contribute to awareness of an election? Because somebody checks in, people who follow them go, oh, yeah, hey, he's a conservative, or he's a liberal, or she's an NDP, or whatever. And it reminds people that there's an election going on, mm-hmm. that their friend is politically aware, and maybe they should be too. So maybe it'll get the vote out. I think it opens up that dialogue as
now,
well.
Now, Michael, I assume that you're standing there because you're unsatisfied with the answer that you received, or are you willing to...
Could we just flick back for like 20 seconds to that question of... I was standing here, actually, because I'm polite. That question of whether you've done any parsing to see whether the tweet conversation is paralleling the national conversation. And I realize you're quite right. That's a loose way of framing it. And what do I mean by that? But I don't know of any other way of putting it.
Is it even technically possible? I think is a reasonable auxiliary question.
Technically possible, may or may not be. I haven't. Part of the problem is I also have a family and a job, and I'm kind of doing this out of personal interest, but also because some of the stuff affects my clients. I actually did an interview this afternoon, and I was asked, "What am I going to do with this mountain of information that I'm gathering?" Because I don't have every tweet that was issued. but I'm capturing a sample set as we go because, you know, it would be interesting to look at the stuff. I was asked what I'm going to do with it, and I said, I don't know yet, but I'll, after May 3rd, I'll figure it out. And a professor has actually texted me and saying, hey, let me know if I can help. I'd be interested in working with you. So I don't have the time right now to dig through all this material, but I think afterwards it'll be interesting to go back when, you know, with the benefit of time and clear head to actually dig into that.
Just to add quickly, I think that asking whether or not it reflects the national conversation, that we're thinking about the national, like we've been, up until now we've thought about what people are talking about in very conventional ways. You know, we've broken people down into demographics based on, you know, regions and based on age groups and based on income groups and that sort of thing. And, this is how we said, well, these people care about this thing, so, you know, and then we can extrapolate that and say the country believes that as a whole. What social media has done and what Twitter has done is, it's important to remember that, you know, when we're talking about what Twitter is interested in, we're talking about what that community is interested in. That community is far greater than the demographic lines that we're used to breaking this information up on. So is it ever going to reflect, accurately the national mood? Well, I mean, it's hard to say, but what it does reflect accurately is the mood of that community, and I think that's important to pay attention to.
Actually, just quickly, just to wrap up the point.
Let's give an opportunity. You'll have more chance with more questions.
Well, I just wanted to just to riff on that point really quickly, and that is that these are people who are also volunteering their points of view with thought, as opposed to answering a sliding scale question on a scale of 1 to 5, how important is this issue to you? So these are people who are actually offering additional polling information or assessment information that we don't have from polls.
Okay. Thanks. My name's Megan Harris, and my question to you, Mark, is this. Have you or are you looking at how politicians in other countries are using social media? And if so, how does that compare to how Canadian politicians are using it?
Wow, that's a great question. I've done a little bit. There's actually, I would say that some of the more fascinating stuff that's going on without going into details is happening in Europe. Because Europe has also embraced a very open approach to government data and engagement. And there's some really great reports that have come out of the UK, Scotland, Ireland, I think. I'm trying to remember, but there's some recent data that has come out where they actually spoke to the MPs about their use of social media, and they measured some of the success of what they're doing. I would say that in many respects, what they're doing is more fascinating than what the United States is doing, the congressmen and congresswomen, all the politicians in the States. Despite the fact that the U.S. gets more hype.
When you say more fascinating, what do you mean by that?
I think they're using the tools more effectively. They're using them especially for petitions and for polling for public sentiment. So they actually put out questions to their public and they get responses. As opposed to engaging in conversation, they say, hey, what does this issue mean to you? Please offer your insight. And they're actually gathering information from that.
So based on the responses, according to your knowledge, then are they actually then using that as a basis for policy decisions or regulatory changes? Or is it just they're putting this information out there, they're getting it and say, oh, that's interesting. Or are they actually doing something with it?
I think it's informing vote decisions within Parliament. Send me an email and I'll see if I can find at least the blog name that has some of this information. There's some really good blogs that follow what's going on in Europe. I wish I could comment more authoritatively. I'll have to refresh my memory.
Hi, my name is April Lindgren. Journalists used to be criticized as the gatekeepers, and I'm wondering, in a sense, haven't we, as journalists, aren't we abdicating the agenda setting to this epicenter that's deciding what the stories are? You talk about, you see a story trending. And that's what we think we better write a story about. So journalists used to decide what set the story based on a whole bunch of complex ideas, and now one of the dominant things we're deciding what stories are is, what's going on the internet, and an agenda that's being set by we don't even know who, because as you say, we don't know if it's 12 computers or 500 people in the epicenter that are actually setting that agenda, and it seems to me this is quite problematic. In terms of a national debate.
I'm not sure if I agree with you that Twitter or social media is, quote unquote, setting the agenda. I think it acts as signposts as to where stories might be. So for example, I'll use the example of this Julian Fantino thing again. You know, somebody tweets that there's this controversial thing that may or may not have happened. Okay, well, let's find out for ourselves. So, you know, a responsible journalist will investigate to see if it is. If it turns out to be an issue that is really, well, has been tweeted, retweeted a lot, that seems to have engaged politicians, such as this debate issue, I think our job is to report on what people are talking about it and what politicians are saying. In a case like that, that to not report on something that would be an abdication of responsibility. So, again, journalism. I mean, I think most people will agree it's all about judgment in a sense that, you know, we decide, you know, what stories go on each page every day, and sometimes for interesting reasons stories don't make it, and that's someone's judgment call. So, I think it's just an extension of that journalistic responsibility that you evaluate a story and decide whether or not it's worthy of the kind of attention that you think it should get. And I think Twitter is just, in my opinion anyway, the way I use it, is it's just another way of getting story ideas or looking at what are people saying, is this worth covering, is there any truth to this? I don't think, at least I don't know any journalist who is letting their guard down in the sense they're just believing what they see and turning it into a story.
Yeah, I totally buy the argument about their story ideas, and
right,
you pull them off. It's the whole idea of sort of what the trending item is, because it seems to me that's so easily manipulated, and that our literacy about who's shaping those trends is where we run into problems. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, certainly. I thought that was an interesting chart that you showed, that showed the original tweets, how they're outnumbered percentage-wise by retweets. And I mean, what Twitter does very well is turn up the volume on things, you know, and that's how we... That's how reporters and editors who are following the election end up learning about something and then trying to chase it down and deciding if that's something they want to write about. I mean, but make no mistake, I mean, you know, mainstream media is still very much the gatekeeper of information in this election, you know, because even though that information may be on Twitter and it's circulating within that community, it's because of the reporters and our newfound, you know, and our new renewed attention to that medium that are finding those stories, turning them into more complete, you know, posts with context, and then raising them out to the national level, you know, outside of that community as well.
Mm-hmm. I would certainly encourage more people to ask questions, although I would say that we are running a little tight on time, maybe 15 minutes tops left before we adjourn to our open bar. So if anything, I would ask the panelists to try to keep your answers as tight as possible so we can allow everyone to...
Everyone talk in 140 characters. Count them off.
I'm Chai Kalivar. And I know the political parties are using social media to get a political advantage. That's the obvious thing. And I would like to know if you can compare the performance or adeptness or creativity of the different political parties in using social media, and any sort of particular incidents that you might have noticed in which they have come out well, way above others and gaining a big political advantage or whatever, something like that.
You want to take a shot at this? I've been talking, I don't mind answering, but you guys...
Oh no, go for it. I just think it's really...
It's a great question.
Interesting question, because like, what does in turning up the volume on Twitter matter?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I haven't been following the party's use of social media as closely as I wanted to, because it's been a demanding job keeping up with everything else, but I've actually started to expand my research. I would say that based on what I've observed so far, the Liberal Party has the edge on understanding the digital culture. They've done some really interesting things with video, with even some blogging, and with Twitter especially. The tone is really mad. It's almost, as I said, when Michael Ignatieff put out his gauntlet-dropping tweet, I said he must have taken a page out of the book of Tony Clement, because he nailed the just the way to say something that would get people excited. The NDP have done a lot of stuff with video, actually. I'm not crazy about some of their videos, but I think they're on the right track. The Conservative Party is presenting itself as not being social media friendly, and they're silencing people as they go. So we see, what's his name, Dobrich, what was his name, the Churchill, Manitoba candidate who had made some comments a year ago about Obama. His Twitter account is now private, and he deleted the comment from his Facebook profile, which almost says more than if he had just acknowledged the comment and said, hey, my opinion has evolved over time. So I think that the Liberals have the edge, and they're certainly getting a lot more mentions as a result. But, you know, does that mean translate into votes? Probably not.
How about the other two parties?
Actually, you know what? So the Green Party, in my own area, I've been fascinated by the Green Party because they are the most responsive. When I tweet things that relate to the candidates in my area, including a post I did called Digital Makeover, in which I kind of critiqued the various websites and social media profiles of the candidates in my area, I tweeted afterwards the names of all the candidates, and the only candidate to reply was actually somebody working on Jen Hunter, who's the Green Party candidate, replied and said, thanks a million for the advice. I've made some changes to our website based on your post. I did hear from the NDP candidate's office a couple days later, but they called about my blog. But there hasn't been a whole lot of response on the Liberal and the Conservative candidate in our area. It just kind of seems absent from a lot of things.
I'll just briefly add that some of the first politicians we saw start to use our geopollster tool were Green Party candidates, actually, which is quite smart because, you know, when you have something that not a lot of people are participating in, you can claim a province for the Greens fairly easily, and they had...
Including Alberta.
They had Alberta, Saskatchewan, and Manitoba for the first week, so good for them.
I'll just make a shameless plug here, which actually relates to the question. I run a site at the Star called Youth Nation 2011, and it's our attempt to create a forum for candidates who are under the age of 30 running in this election to talk about the issues that matter to them, to have a voice, to blog about it, to argue with each other. And the biggest response that we got, at least from the social media side, was from the Greens. Now, that's, I think, partly because there aren't very many candidates for the other three parties that are over 30, that are under 30 and are running. But they're very engaged. They're quick to respond to things on Twitter, and they're very they seem to be quite savvy with it. Like they
also recognize, I think, the cost effectiveness of using social.
Exactly, because as we know, the Green Party doesn't have a huge budget, and I mean they're probably not going to get any seats. But at the same time, they're using it. I guess they're trying to basically use every angle at every tool at their disposal to get their profile up. And I mean, at least on this site, for what it is. They own it because they're the ones who are using social media to get their message out.
So I think to answer your question, it's still elementary school days in which the grades are satisfactory or unsatisfactory. And in that sense, it's a pretty mixed bag. But we are running short on time.
Just to cover the nation, are any one of you fluent in French and following Quebec?
I'm doing some analysis of the French language tweets, and Hootsuite actually has a great feature which allows me to translate French tweets to English because my French is not so great. It's a much smaller conversation out there, but it is more conversational than the rest of Canada.
So we have time for two last questions or comments. Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Bill Doscott. I'm a journalist here in Toronto. Did I hear you right in saying there was 38,000 tweets on debate day?
Debate, yeah. Well, no, there was actually 70,000 tweets, or more than 70,000 tweets debate day. There was I can't remember the exact. I think it was 35,500 tweets on the debate alone, on that day. So that represented 50% of the traffic, was of 70,000 roughly.
That was using the DB8 hashtag.
That was debate related using the debate hashtag. So there was a huge amount of traffic.
Actually, I find that kind of pathetic because the TV audience was 4 million for the entire debate and about 10 million people watched at least part of it. So, you know, like I personally accounted for 4 DB8 tweets. But if you break it down, if you just use the 4 million, there was one tweet for every 1,000 viewers. I don't find that to be huge.
No, but what's interesting about that is it's a focus group. What landed in the debate? What issues, you know, people, yeah. One of the things that, to the point of story finding, I was actually in the CP offices during the English debate, and there were people tweeting like crazy, where is Prime Minister Harper's wedding band? And so suddenly, wow, that, you know, he isn't wearing his wedding band. Mm-hmm. So Stephanie Levitz and I started sifting through 5 years of video and said, You know, he's never worn his wedding band. There's visits of him at the farm. So it's amazing what people notice, and they'll tweet that stuff. You know, there are a variety of comments when Ignatieff put his hand on his hip, that rubbed people the wrong way. And so it actually, it's a feedback mechanism. It's almost like the people sitting in the TV room with their little clicker.
It's a feedback mechanism. It's also a spin mechanism. I'd like to know how many of the 38,000 actually worked or are affiliated with some political organization.
You're
but
absolutely
I
right.
To, but one question I wanted to get to of a commercial nature is, I know that CBC.ca claimed that 75,000 people took part in their online chat about the debate. Now, as a media organization, do you want to focus on having your own proprietary chats using your own stars? I think CTV.ca held a live chat with like Nick Nanos. Or do you want to take part in the wider conversation through an open tool like Twitter, for example?
And ironically, you notice there's a similarity between Mark's numbers and CBC's numbers? That he, you know, was talking 70,000 and they were talking 70,000? It might be because CBC was using a hybrid model in which they captured all the public activity and then branded it as their own.
Well, it was really wild when Mansbridge was talking about the numbers of various issues, and he's like quoting numbers that I had put out there. I was like, whoa, you might as well say my name.
Sorry, you want to say, Chris?
No, I just wanted to quickly say, Bill, that you know, there's always a point where you have to make the decision between hosting your own live conversation or just entering into the conversation at large, and it basically comes down to whether or not you want to control it. You want to give people the opportunity to have their say, but you want to have it in a forum that works for you and creates a product for you. That's when you have it inside. If you just want to enter into that conversation, you can do that anytime.
What's interesting, by the way, about debate night is greater than 60% of the tweets were original content. A small sliver, I think it was like 2 or 3%, were replies. And the balance were retweets, which means people weren't really reading what was going on online. They were just jamming a whole bunch of content into the channel. Hmm. So if you were watching the debate, you were probably sitting with your laptop. Oh, you know, hashtag fail. Yeah. That was a funny comment.
Hi, Hugh Windsor is my name. I've been professionally curious over the years as to the campaign managers, what they're doing to try and influence us and through us, the electorate. You four monitor the Twitter universe more than any of the rest of us here, I think. And so I have a couple of questions on that score. One, from your monitoring of the Twitter universe during the campaign so far, have you been able to identify various ways that individual campaigns have changed gears or changed issues? Or, in other words, are the professional political managers, if you like, using monitoring the Twitter universe to shift their priorities, shift where they're going, or how they're running their ads, or in other words, is it having an impact that way? Mm-hmm. Secondly, monitoring that same universe, are you seeing anything that would either confirm or conflict what the random selection polling is showing, which, and I defer to Alan on my left over here, but what it appears is that there is not much moving out there. And I'm just wondering, that's based on the published random polls, random selected polls. Does the Twitter universe indicate that there is political choice change going on out there, which isn't being indicated by this other form of communication?
So I think those are two great questions to use as sort of closing remarks. And, you know, I think they both address what is really either the myth or the promise of social media. Are the campaigns using it in a way, as you've described, in terms of the feedback to alter it? And finally, is this election going to have any impact because of social media? Or are we going to end up with the exact same configuration of parliament that we started with? And what does that say about all this newfangled media? Big questions that I don't expect any of us to answer exhaustively, but I think it's a good way for us to close the discussion. Mark, do you want to start us off?
To answer the question about campaign managers and changing campaign activities as a result of Twitter, I haven't seen or spoken to anybody about this specifically. Campaigns are very guarded. They won't talk, obviously. But anecdotally, I wonder, for example, with the one-on-one debate, if that was an attempt to regain some control of the conversation and to regain some of the limelight that had been lost because of Elizabeth May and the Green Party. So that's how I'd answer that question. And to keep it short, to jump into what impact it will have with the vote, I think a vast majority of the people who are participating in the conversation online are already decided voters. They're already liberals, they're already conservatives, they're already NDP or Greens or Bloc. And so they're just contributing to the conversation or making their views heard. I don't believe that a vast majority of people out there, or you know, even a modest majority of people, are there to find out which direction they're going to swing their vote, because you know I just don't think that that's where they are. It might be that some people change, and I think the only day that I saw any indication that people were changing their votes was the day that the G8 draft report was leaked. And I saw a few tweets from people, but then again, you have to question the authenticity that suggested that they, you know, they're done with the conservative parties, or you know, that's it. They're not going to vote for the conservative party. I think that to the point of the previous questioner, there is absolutely spin out there, and while we don't know all the accounts, there are clearly some accounts that are part of the spin machine that are trying to spin the conversation, but with little if no effect. They're just contributing to the chatter.
I would say no. I don't think campaign managers are using Twitter to try and launch other parts of their campaign, because I still think the mainstream media is the primary tool for getting your message out to the greatest number of people, and I think that'll stay that way for quite a while until every single person in Canada has a Twitter account. And I also agree with Mark, and I think we're seeing this with our experience with Youth Nation, is that the people who are participating in it, the young people who are under 30, who are engaged politically and who are interested in issues and are opinionated about them, are the kind of people who are already voters. They do it every year, and I think the statistics still speak volumes about the engagement of not only young people but most Canadians. I think the stats for people between the ages of 18 and 25 is something like around 30 to 35% actually vote. So that's anywhere between 65 and 70% of people, young people eligible to vote, just don't care. And I don't think that, maybe I'm wrong here, but I don't think that Rick Mercer going on TV or people tweeting about it's actually going to encourage these people to go out and vote. Maybe that's a really cynical viewpoint, but I just don't see it yet.
I'll just add that if campaign managers weren't watching the conversation about their parties, I'd be shocked. I mean, that would be a very negligent thing to do. I know from a product development perspective at the Post, whenever we launch a new feature of the site or a new platform for delivering information, we put it out there in the wild, and then we set up a bunch of searches for keywords to see what people are saying about what we do. And it's a way to just collect feedback instantly that can help you enhance the product that you're creating for the target market that you're trying to reach. And this is absolutely one of the big strengths of Twitter, and I'm sure that they're paying attention and doing the same thing. Maybe not in ways that we can notice, but I'm sure it's there. In terms of whether or not it'll actually influence the outcome of the election, I mean, I think the point made that we're talking about decided voters are the most active people in the conversation. I think that's true, but I think that with any sort of prognostication, with any sort of poll, I mean, it's all just make-believe until people actually go out and vote, right? I mean, you know, there's a big difference between what people say they're going to do and what they actually do, so hard to say.
Well, I think if anything, what we've sort of talked about tonight is how open-ended, how early days the phenomena is. And explicitly, I'm interested in the manipulation, in the spin potential, and in the activity I've been monitoring as part of the election. It is largely partisan. It is largely not necessarily coming from the war rooms, but extending the war room as a kind of virtual place in which you're trying to have your candidate, have your side better represented. And in that sense, I think as a good way to close, it's to remind people that this is the 100th birthday or the 100th anniversary of Marshall McLuhan's birth, And if anything, I think we've demonstrated that in the case of Twitter and politics, the medium is the message. It's not the content of Twitter that matters, but the fact that it's reducing our attention span, reducing the way we can deal with issues in an alarming way that simplifies the process rather than including new participation. So I suspect there will be an opportunity when voting day comes, when we end up with the exact same parliament with less people voting, wondering if, in fact, the promises associated with social media are legitimate, if not, in fact, it's all just a larger distraction.
Can I ask you one quick question since you brought up McLuhan?
Okay, very quick.
Twitter, hot or cold media?
Neither. Again, we have an opportunity, I think, to close. I would remind people to stick around for the open bar. Our panel will be there to answer your questions, to get into further arguments. I appreciate and thank all the folks who participated via Twitter. I was making an effort to sort of follow the discussion. Thankfully, there was a symbiosis between what was articulated verbally and what was articulated virtually. So I thank you all again for coming and give one last opportunity for our fine friends at the CJF to remind you why they do such great things.
Well, I'd like to thank our panelists, Mark Blevis, Kenyon Wallace, Chris Boutette, and our moderator, Jesse Hirsch, for sharing some fascinating statistics and for a stimulating discussion. Our next forum on May 17th will welcome some of the minds behind Canada's online news startups, including Jeff Anders from The Mark, James Baxter of iPolitics, David Beers from The Tie, and Wilf Dinnick of OpenFile. The forum will be moderated by BNN anchor Andrea Mandel-Campbell. Thanks for being here tonight, and thanks again to BMO Financial Group for making this evening possible. Please join us upstairs for some refreshments and nibbles and more conversation on social media and Election 41. Thank you.
Sure, I'll put the best parts up on YouTube.
So is that a...